From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park Podcast.
Welcome to the November 2025 episode of the Bletchley Park Podcast, Reaping the Whirlwind. During the second half of World War II, the Allied Air Forces launched a large-scale, heavy bomber offensive against German cities and war industries. This was designed to damage Germany's ability and will to continue the war. It also represented a way for Britain and the USA to support the Soviet Union before the D-Day invasion. The whole campaign was guided by intelligence to identify the right targets, determine how badly they were damaged, and assess the effects on the German war effort. This huge undertaking taxed Allied intelligence capabilities to their limits. It has since become one of the many contended issues in the debates around this costly and controversial campaign. In this It Happened Here episode, we're joined by Research Officer Dr. Thomas Cheetham to explain the ways signals intelligence from Bletchley Park did and didn't guide Allied bombing strategy. Our thanks go to Owen Mugan and Sarah Langston for voicing our historical documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
Object: primarily the progressive destruction and dislocation of the German military, industrial, and economic systems, and the undermining of the morale of the German people to a point where their capacity for armed resistance is fatally weakened. Every opportunity to be taken to attack Germany by day, to destroy objectives that are unsuitable for night attack, to sustain continuous pressure on German morale, to impose heavy losses on German day fighter force, and to conserve German fighter force away from the Russian and Mediterranean theaters of war.
Now, Tom, that piece we've just listened to is what becomes known as the Point Blank Directive. This is put together at the Casablanca Conference in early 1943. Now, it's quite plain what targets they need to be bombing, but how do they find out what these targets are? It's all well and good saying this is what you've got to go and bomb. How do the two air forces know what to bomb?
So there's so many ways of splitting up this problem.
Right.
That's what I found really interesting when I was looking to doing the research for this episode. The intelligence problem that supports bombing is not one-dimensional. The basic problems are target identification and damage assessment. What are you going to bomb and how are you going to know that you've hit it? But you can split both of those up into kind of large scale and small scale. You've got the identification of specific targets, specific factories, rail yards, oil plants, whatever, and whether you've bombed them effectively enough to put them out of action. And then you've got the large scale picture. What are the broad target sets, you might call them, which you want to attack, which might make a difference to the strategic picture and damage Germany's ability to continue the war? And how do you gauge you're having the right effect on those targets and it is having that strategic effect?
So if we're targeting oil plants, how's that knocking on to, you know, have they got fuel for tanks? Have they got fuel for aircraft? Stuff like that.
Yeah, and even that splits down because it's how much oil is coming out of the refineries, how much is in Germany, what's the German strategic reserve compared to how much does a tank division have at the front? So there are so many ways of approaching this issue, which is why the intelligence picture is so complicated. The other interesting thing to point out about the Point Blank Directive is that reference to morale, this idea of morale as a target. I mean, this had come about originally because when Bomber Command was on its own attacking Germany in sort of 1941, 1942, they can't fly over Germany by day, it's too dangerous. They have to bomb at night, but at night the navigational problem is so severe that they can't find specific targets. The RAF kind of goes into the war expecting to do precision bombing and then finds that that's basically impossible. This is why they adopt area bombing and the idea of civilian morale as a target, the idea that you can still find a city, so if you just plaster it, you have this obviously very controversial concepts of dehousing and things like that that come about in this period. These are not approaches which are chosen
the only option,
necessarily,
isn't it?
But they're chosen out of necessity because Bomber Command can't really achieve anything better. On this occasion, the target identification sort of follows the capabilities. Then there is a hope that if the cities are bombed enough, then general disorganisation and general demoralisation of the population will have an impact on industries, even if you can't actually hit a factory. Or if you've thrown off bombs at a city, you might hit a lot of houses, but you also end up hitting the factory sooner or later. These are the RAF kind of making the best of a bad job in terms of what its capabilities are. By 1943, and by the time the Americans join in, really, the Bomber Command is getting a lot better, and you see very heavy raids hitting Germany during 1943, thanks to heavier bombers, better navigational systems especially. Even then, though, you look at how big Germany is and how many cities are in Germany, yeah. And you think about how, even if everything goes perfectly and Bomber Command can heavily damage a city every few nights, how often can you keep hitting that city to keep production down? It's quite clear that the number of possible targets in Germany are just too many, too varied and too dispersed for the Allies to hit all of them, even if they had 4,000 bombers or whatever yeah. the aspiration is, which they never achieve, by the way.
No, I mean, when they do, say, like with Cologne or Hamburg, it's for a very short period and it's a real sort of hit because it's so severe. But, you know, the evidence since the war has proven that they might have knocked out 70% of the housing or something, but within 3 months, everything's back up and running
again. Yeah, definitely,
again.
If not weeks. So the problem the Allies have is a really severe one in terms of how to use their bombers properly. And that's why you get this focus on particular target sets, starting off with point blank and thinking about the Luftwaffe as a target, the German Air Force. But there's other considerations too, because a big motivation behind point blank is thinking about Overlord and the fact that wherever the invasion takes place, it's going to need air superiority. And therefore, the chiefs of staff decide they need to take the Luftwaffe out of the picture. And the best way to do that is to bring them into combat by attacking targets which they can't afford to not defend. And the targets that they can't afford to not defend are aircraft factories and their own airfields. So this is behind most of the American operations.
Through the cold of the English early morning, the combat crews go to their mess. They have no idea where they're going yet, but they know they'll be taking off in about 4 hours. The 4,000 men who will go on this mission all know it will be a rugged deal. For some of them, it's their first mission. Others are veterans of many.
Happy to get through.
Now, at all the groups in the Bomber Command, the air crews are assembling in the briefing rooms to learn the target for today.
Target for the day is Ankrum. Specifically, you have to destroy the Arado factory. This plant manufactures aircraft components, principally wing and tail assemblies for the Focke-Wulf 190. The parts are then shipped to New Brandenburg for assembly. I cannot stress upon you too much the importance of this target. If it is successfully destroyed, it will have a very serious effect on Germany's aircraft production. Light, please.
On the perimeters of 20-odd fields of the 8th Air Force, more than 400 Forts and Liberators, with their 4,000 crew members, taxi for the takeoff.
Later on, they turn their attention to oil targets because they know fuel is a problem for the German military. And that's a major focus during 1944. And then after D-Day, there's also a focus on transportation targets, looking at those rail yards, canals, pieces of infrastructure that are used to move materials around Germany. And again, they're identified as targets which, if taken out, have a disproportionate impact on the German war economy. What this means is, from an intelligence point of view, early in the war, or in maybe the first half of the strategic bombing campaign, there's a belief amongst the intelligence authorities in Britain that you can analyse the German war economy to a level of detail that enables you to kind of determine when it will crack. And you have the Ministry of Economic Warfare coming up with its forecast for production in all the German key industries. They're using lots of what we might call open source intelligence for that now, things like press reporting, information they're gleaning from their diplomatic missions in neutral countries, tidbits of information from POWs, enemy propaganda, and everything they know from before the war, of course, about how the German economy is set up. And this idea that if you're plastering the cities and you're trying to cause that general kind of moral collapse, then you will be able to determine through good intelligence when the enemy are reaching that point. By about 1943, along with that switch to more precise targets, you know, the intelligence experts are realizing that sort of analysis really isn't possible. It's just not achievable.
No, I can't see how it would be, you know. It's a guess, isn't it, at the very best?
Exactly. So then the intelligence effort becomes much more focused on particular targets and limited numbers of specific targets and their effects on the German war effort.
So what different sources of intelligence are playing into this picture?
There's a big source which we have to get out of the way maybe early because it's not signals intelligence, but right. It's photo reconnaissance. This is probably the premier source used for post-raid assessment, definitely. A lot of target assessment as well before raids is based on very detailed air photography. You have RAF Medmenham as the centre where all of this is going on. And then a nice link to Bletchley Park here, of course, is that Frederick Winterbottom, who sets up Humphrey at yep. Bletchley Park, he also pioneers air photography before the war. He gets a pilot called Sidney Cotton to fly an adapted Lockheed Electra over Germany and basically proves that high altitude air photography works and then can get good photos.
Oh, I didn't realise it was Winterbottom did that.
Yeah, it's Winterbottom.
I've
who
heard
does
of
this.
That, but not that it was Winterbottom.
And obviously by later in the war, that effort is built up to a really, really high standard and has all sorts of impacts, which you won't go into here, which is kind of outside our area of expertise. But the link to Bletchley Park is a relatively minor one. Douglas Kendall, who's the station commander at Medmenham, he's the only member of staff there who apparently is indoctrinated to receive Ultra.
Right, okay.
I've not seen any evidence that he gets raw decrypts or they have a special liaison unit or anything like this. He seems to, you know, get relevant information from Air Ministry and be able to pass it and then point his photo interpreters in the right direction and towards the ones they do need to focus on.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole point. They're one of the sources as opposed to needing to know what to do with the material, really, aren't they?
Yeah, but if Kendall knows that, for example, an Ultra message is just reported in good detail the damage to a particular fuel plant, he doesn't need to get his photo interpreters to put that at the
right.
top of their list.
Okay, yeah.
So there is this connection between photo reconnaissance and Bletchley Park. That really underpins everything, and it's quite complementary with this signals intelligence, actually.
What other sources have we got then?
But most of your other sources are SIGINT. A really important source which comes up time and time again in the books I've been reading is Japanese diplomatic traffic. So we know we've spoken before about how the Americans broke the purple cipher before World War II. They have this source of intelligence they know as magic, which is vital in the war effort against Japan. But purple is also being used to send reports back to Tokyo from Japanese ambassador in Berlin, General Oshima. We know that's vital before D-Day in determining, you know, the success of the Allied deception campaigns and building up certain parts of the picture. And alongside the ambassador, you've got military attachés and air and naval attachés in Berlin and various other places across Europe. And they're all sending information back to Japan, either in the purple cipher or in different, less complicated codes and ciphers. A lot of that material is being broken at Bletchley Park.
We've got an example of the sort of traffic that you're talking about here.
Yeah, so the official history of British intelligence reproduces a decrypt describing a conversation between General Oshima and Field Marshal Milch, Erich Milch, who is the senior Luftwaffe official in charge of aircraft production. And this is from 17th of August, 1943.
My interview with Field Marshal Milch lasted for about an hour and a half. I said that there had recently been extraordinary activity on the part of the British and American Air Forces, and that the Field Marshal had told me some time ago that Germany was carrying out a great expansion of the Luftwaffe to counter this activity. I had myself visited two or three factories and knew the general situation. But how long it would take, I asked, to bring the Luftwaffe up to a point where it could offer effective resistance. Milch showed me figures and plans for the increased production of planes and, speaking very frankly, said that to tell the truth, the Luftwaffe was in considerable difficulties since America was at present sending the greater part of the planes which she was producing in large quantities to Europe. A strong air force was absolutely essential to victory, and accordingly, Germany was doing her utmost to increase production. At present, the monthly output of first-class fighting planes was 2,700 a month. This figure is particularly confidential. And in about 15 months' time, it would be double. These plans were proceeding smoothly, and production during the last 4 months had been 170 more than anticipated, so that he expected the plans to be carried out earlier than originally thought. I then asked whether the recent British and American air raids had not affected the plans for the expansion of the Luftwaffe. Milch replied that the raids had been very violent and that the damage inflicted upon production plants in the Ruhr area and elsewhere was not lightly to be dismissed. On the 13th of August, American planes from Benghazi had visited Wiener Neustadt, had bombed the factories making fighter planes, and had caused considerable damage. No fighter squadrons had, however, been assigned to that district, so that the fighters just completed in the factories had been unable to put up a fight. For these reasons, the production of bombers was not being given priority at present, and first place was being given to fighters and destroyer planes, Zerstörer, while the defenses were being strengthened. Looking at the situation as a whole, however, since the production of munitions was entirely under the control of the government, so that they could give orders quickly as regards the distribution and allocation of work to factories, since the British and American bombing consisted largely in the bombing of towns, and since the reconstruction of damaged factories was proceeding satisfactorily, the damage done to production establishments was very small as compared with the damage done to ordinary houses, and was not more than 10% of Germany's total productive potential. Judging from these remarks made by Milch, it is plain that at the moment the German Air Force is very inferior to that of the United Nations. We must recognize that for the time being, the conduct of the war by Germany will continue to be difficult.
You can hear from that extract that you are getting good information from the horse's mouth, from senior German officials, the impact they think strategic bombing is having, how they're reacting to it, how their air force is weathering it, and their plans for the future, which is obviously invaluable, but you have to understand that these Japanese reports are very subjective sources. Firstly, the Japanese are not getting often accurate, solid information from the Germans. They're getting, to a certain extent, propaganda. They're getting the narrative the Germans want them to hear. Sometimes the people they're talking to are quite honest, and sometimes they're not.
The Germans aren't generally that honest with their supposed allies.
No, they're
they?
Not the closest of allies. And then the Japanese officials, of course, have varying degrees of credulousness. And so it's very, very hard to take these sources at face value. They give you a good overview, and they sometimes give you a good insight, but they're often contradictory to each other. You know, they're not the sort of sources you can say that will give you that complete kind of statistical picture of how the German economy is doing that you really want. There's one post-war history that I found which actually tells us that in one case, the Japanese consul at Vienna told Tokyo that he'd been falsifying his own reports back to Tokyo.
Right.
So that the Russians might intercept them and then be misled into urging the Anglo-American air forces to a course of action detrimental to them. So there's all sorts of layers of misinformation and misconception and kind of intentional deception going on here in these Japanese communications, which make them really, really problematic as kind of economic intelligence sources, as important as they are.
Do we have any more, should we say, reliable sources of intelligence?
Well, if you keep going through the second sources, the next one we might talk about is German police interceptions.
So what are they?
You've got the German military using radio, and in just the same way the German police service is using radio. You've got several different police services in Germany, and you've got the civilian police forces, and you've got militarized ones. And we know especially about German police intelligence because of the Einsatzgruppen on the Eastern Front following behind the German invasion, who are carrying out mass murders of Jews, are police forces using these ciphers. They use relatively simple ciphers. They're broken in the military section of Bletchley Park as a separate problem from Enigma. And what they see towards the end of the war is that the German police are pulled into civil defence, and they're often the ones reacting to the effects of air raids. So they're coordinating with firefighters, with their kind of air raid precautions organisation in Germany, with the people responsible for evacuating the cities when they're bombed, or for organising the supply of essential materials or
food. You get any kind of post-bombing reports that way.
So all of this, when a raid happens, all of these radio networks burst into life, them coordinating their response to the raids.
Right, okay.
And that only intensifies when the raids get especially heavy and they start knocking out the landline communications. They need to rely on radio.
Yes, of course.
So all of that is intercepted in the UK. And that gives you an insight certainly into the effects of raids on the ground. If nothing else, it tells you when a city has been badly hit and when it hasn't. We have an extract here from an ATS Y operator at the Bowmanor Y station called Gwen Gibbs, talking about intercepting this traffic.
At the beginning of 1944, there was no actual fighting in France, apart from some sporadic bursts of activity caused by small raids. Most of the really active stations were the large towns, particularly in the Ruhr area, which were covered by the police groups. They worked a different system from STAR, as there was no actual control, and each station was individual, although they had links to other stations, particularly Berlin. I started on one of the police groups, which were always very busy on the evening and night shifts because of continual bombing raids on the main towns. With the later daytime raids by the American Flying Fortresses, it became almost a round-the-clock operation. The main towns my group covered were Hamburg, Hanover, Essen, and I think Bremerhaven. One night on Hanover, it was frantic. There were two of us hard at it, and we took turns in taking the message or the log. I was logging at the time when suddenly one of the stations broke procedure and gave an uncoded message in clear text. I called our supervisor, who understood German. He said that the sender was saying that they had run out of water because the bombing had caused a firestorm.
What about the more, what we think of more traditional ultra sources?
Absolutely. So this is quite a complicated question to answer, but ultra definitely feeds into the picture. It's vital. So if we're thinking about those different questions you want to answer, ultra is one of the most important ways of working out what your big strategic target systems are. So as early as, I think, early 1941, the RAF issues a directive to Bomber Command saying attack aircraft plants, because we know from our order of battle information based on ultra that the Luftwaffe fighter arm is relatively low on planes. So if we hit the aircraft factories, we're going to exacerbate that shortage. And this only continues. The Allies at every stage, certainly by the second half of the war, have almost perfect sort of operational level intelligence on the German air forces. So they know, you know, if you either day fighter or night fighter forces, they know what the bombers are going to be up against. They know where those aircraft are based. They know how many of them there are. They know what condition they're in to fight. They can make all these very important tactical decisions with almost perfect knowledge of what they're up against. It doesn't mean they always have the perfect big picture of the Luftwaffe, mainly because a lot of the Luftwaffe is on the Eastern Front, and the coverage on the Eastern Front is not great. It never is, because they just don't have the intercept capacity to pick up all those signals. So you can't necessarily use ultra to prove that your estimates for the size of the Luftwaffe are perfect or to plot everything out. But certainly, you know, in terms of what forces the Germans have in the West and in Germany itself, they have a very good idea of how they're organized. And this means when you have that point-blank directive that says target the German Air Force, you can use ultra to gauge the effectiveness of that campaign with quite a lot of success. When you're thinking about target sets to attack, ultra supports that as well. It gives a sense of concerns amongst the enemy ranks about particular shortages. So before they really start bombing oil, one of the reasons they know oil is possibly a vulnerable spot is because the Germans are sending messages to each other about fuel shortages or laying down economy measures, saying training units shouldn't use too much fuel because it will reduce our strategic oil stocks. Again, Japanese diplomatic messages contain lots of references like this as well. General concern about oil levels, which is evident even before you start bombing those targets, helps you justify the targeting decisions you're making.
So if you read a load of reports that said, we haven't got enough tanks for this attack, then you might start focusing on tank plants.
It would point you in that direction.
Yeah. So you're looking for things to exacerbate their problems.
That's exactly right. And what you see, of course, in ultra is that as the oil campaign takes effect, as shortages become more severe, you see that coming up in the operational traffic and in the order of battle information that you have. You can see the German units dwindling away. You can see the Luftwaffe dwindling away. You can see the army units are restricting the amount of transport they have available because they're short on fuel. You see that operational impact at the front line. Sometimes you can also use ultra for direct post-damage assessment after raids.
Similar to how they do with the police networks.
Exactly. Again, especially once those landline networks start being hit, being damaged by the bombing, the military authorities report on the damage to civilian industry. But again, these are quite problematic sources. So I've got another quote from that post-war history that I used earlier, talking about ultra intercepts that mention the damage done by raids. It says, it should be pointed out most of them are of little value in assessing the actual damage done. They originate haphazardly from the smallest local to the largest regional command. Most of them are sent too soon for even experts to appraise the actual damage. What's more, our targets are usually industrial, and these are strictly military reports from men who had no way of assessing the actual industrial damage and often had an obvious concern to minimise it, as the defence was their responsibility. So the best of our damage assessments came from other sources. So what you're getting is like decrypts from the FLAC unit defending an oil refinery, saying the refinery was badly hit in kind of vague terms like that. And what does that actually mean in practice? Again, it helps you know your bombers made their way to the target and did something. But in order to get a good idea of that damage, and, you know, then you can start making estimates about the amount of time it will take for the plant to be repaired and, you know, how production might fall in the meantime and start making those statistical deductions, you're going to have to draw on other sources. So that's where your photo reconnaissance comes in especially.
The Nazis entered this war under the rather childish delusion that they were going to bomb everybody else and nobody was going to bomb them. At Rotterdam, London, Warsaw, and half a hundred other places, they put that rather naive theory into operation. They sowed the wind, and now they are going to reap the whirlwind. Cologne, Lubeck, Rostock, those are only just the beginning. We cannot send 1,000 bombers a time over Germany every time as yet. But the time will come when we can do so. When the storm bursts over Germany, they will look back to the days of Lubeck and Rostock and Cologne as a man caught in the blasts of a hurricane will look back to the gentle zephyrs of last summer. It may take a year, it may take two, but for the Nazis, the writing is on the wall. There are a lot of people who say that bombing can never win a war. Well, my answer to that is that it has never been tried yet, and we shall see. Germany, clinging more and more desperately to her widespread conquests and even seeking foolishly for more, will make a most interesting initial experiment. Japan will provide the confirmation. But the time is not yet. There is a great deal of work to be done first, and let us all get down to it.
Well, I think it's about time we turned to one of the controversial figures of this story, the man who gives us the actual title of this episode, indeed, Arthur Harris, or as he's more widely known, Bomber Harris. He's become a very controversial figure post-war, hasn't he?
Yes, Commander-in-Chief of Bomber Command from February 1942. And he's seen as the man, you know, chiefly responsible for this area bombing campaign and the massive destruction wrought by the RAF on German cities.
Now, the simplified version of the story is the Americans want to pick certain targets, so they might pick a ball bearing factory or an oil refinery, but all Harris wants to do is dehouse people. That's the headline that we're told, isn't it?
Yeah, that's broadly correct, but there's a certain amount of nuance we can add to that. Firstly, by saying, you know, as I alluded to before, the reason Bomber Command is doing area bombing is because it can't do anything better.
No.
It doesn't mean they don't want to do precision bombing, they just can't. And Bomber Harris, what's often remarked about him is that he has too little confidence in his own crews, in their own ability to accurately hit their targets. And certainly by 1944, 1945, Bomber Command is actually a very accurate force because you have Oboe, you have the Pathfinder force who are able to target mark very effectively, especially on clear nights. And then because your British bombers fly individually and each bomb on the target marker, you can achieve a very high concentration. And this is something Bomber Harris actually kind of denies for a long time because he doesn't want to overpromise and underdeliver in terms of what his crews can achieve. He thinks being relatively modest in your expectations is probably the right approach. He believes he can cause general disruption of the German war effort through these mass attacks on cities and just through general disruption and general damage to morale. And that's going to be just as good as attempting to hit a factory and then possibly missing it. And the other thing is he wants to keep his crews alive. I think, you know, he's often presented as quite a callous figure, but I don't think there's much evidence for that. He's clearly somebody who cares very deeply for the men under his command. And he doesn't want them to put themselves in the line of fire in what is an enormously hazardous job to be in Bomber Command on missions that might go wrong. The Americans, by contrast, are willing to suffer quite high casualties in that pursuit of precision. But if you look at how they bomb in these large box formations, these combat boxes, which can be a couple of miles wide, with hundreds of aircraft all bombing on a lead bomber, well, it doesn't matter how accurately the lead bomber drops his bombs, but since all the other bombers are spread out in that formation, their bombs are going to go over a wide area, whatever happens.
Yeah, they're not bombing in a pickle barrel, are they?
No. So if you look at the actual accuracy achieved by the Americans compared to the British, there isn't that much difference. And if anything, the British probably are more accurate in their night bombing than the Americans are in their day bombing. They're both doing area bombing, in practical fact.
One of the things that Harris is accused of is that he was completely against bombing what he called panacea targets. So in this case, let's say oil targets. Is that true?
Yeah, he is against bombing panacea targets, yeah. Again, there's kind of good reasons for that. It's not just because he's obtuse and because he wants to kill Germans. It's because earlier in the war, especially the Ministry of Economic Warfare, particularly attracted his ire because they had given him so many promises about the economic effects of bombing this marshalling yard or this ball bearing factory. And none of these had produced any apparent result, and certainly not led to a German collapse. So, for example, you have the ball bearing plants at Schweinfurt, which are bombed a couple of occasions by the Americans, but also by Bomber Command. And there's a point where the MEW works out that they've reduced ball bearing production to below 50%. And Bomber Harris turns around and says, then why are the Germans still fighting? Because you told me damage of this scale would cause a collapse, and it hasn't. And he's kind of right. And the fact is, they hadn't accounted for the fact that the Germans had lots of ball bearings in storage, so that damage to that plant didn't translate into the knock-on effects to the rest of the war industry that you might expect. And by the time that happens, production is back up and running again. So Harris has good reason, you know, to be skeptical about the way any particular target, if destroyed, will disrupt the whole German economy. And he's been right before. So when it comes to late 1944 and he gets these directives down from the air staff to hit oil targets, he's resistant and wants to continue bombing the cities. It's worth pointing out that he does bomb those oil targets, something that Seb Cox at the Air Historical Branch has pointed out on quite a few occasions. By the end of 1944, all of Bomber Command's oil targets have been attacked and destroyed. So he does fulfill his directives when ordered, but it doesn't mean he won't have the argument.
Yeah, because I mean, the early part of 1944, basically Bomber Command is given over to Schaeff in preparation for D-Day, isn't it? And he completely follows those orders until he's released from Schaeff Command.
Yeah, what's kind of surprising is that Bomber Command is the kind of big advocate of strategic bombing that can win the war on its own. And yet he gets on very well with Eisenhower. And when Eisenhower asks for tactical support from heavy bombers, he gets it. And they actually have a very good working relationship and think very highly of each other, which is perhaps surprising. But Harris can separate out his feelings about how the war should be fought from his personal relationships with various people. He's quite capable of doing that.
Press home your attack. If you individually succeed, you will have delivered the most devastating blow against the very vitals of the enemy. Let him have it right on the chin. Send that message to all groups and stations.
That was how Air Marshal Harris, Commander-in-Chief Bomber Command, gave his instructions for the largest air raid the world has ever known. At aerodromes up and down the country, well over 1,000 British-built bombers were being prepared for their journey over the heart of Germany's biggest industrial center, the Ruhr. While armorers and fitters were at work on the machines, the air crews were receiving final instructions from station commanders. Outside, the huge bombers were being loaded with the largest cargo of high-explosive and incendiary bombs ever to be carried by one striking force to a single objective. At dusk, the colossal force set out. Heavy bombers of many types took off from aerodromes all over the country. Only perfect staff work could have achieved the devastating success of this raid. For something like an hour and a half, bombs were dropping at the rate of about 20 tons a minute. Just work that out.
So if we go back to oil, you're saying that he did bomb all the oil targets, even though he didn't want to
He did eventually, but there's definitely an argument to be made that Bomber Command could have kind of done more and earlier against oil targets. And this is something that's been discussed in a lot of the books, but there is a particular period of correspondence between Charles Portal, Chief of the Air Staff, and Harris, where Portal is trying to persuade him to come round to backing the oil campaign, and Harris is pushing back, and they have this back and forth argument for a couple of months at the end of 1944. And this is where Ultra comes into the picture, because there's this mythology, I think it's fair to call it mythology, which is built up around the kind of counterfactual of what if Harris had better intelligence, would it have been possible for Portal to win that argument, bring Harris round to bombing oil plants a couple of months earlier, maybe shorten the war? The misconception that's come about is that Harris was deprived of the intelligence he needed, especially Ultra. And I think this is really interesting because it rests on these misconceptions about what Ultra is, the sort of information it gives you, and how it's disseminated, which are quite useful to delve into. The chief people we're talking about who this comes from is firstly John Stubbington, who's written a couple of books about RAF support for Bomber Command. And he's broadly critical for quite good reason about how, and we talked about this in the previous episodes, about how long it takes Bomber Command to get good tactical intelligence from Bletchley Park, those BMP reports that we were talking about in the other episodes. And he kind of extends this argument to Ultra, which is a different kettle of fish at the end of the day. It's a different source of intelligence, and it's handled by completely different channels. before John Stubbington, you had Rafe Bennett, who we've mentioned many times in the past in this podcast. He's one of the first analysts of Ultra. He goes to the archives in the late 70s and reads all of the Ultra traffic that's available. He writes Ultra in the West about the campaign after D-Day, and then he writes Ultra Mediterranean Strategy. And those are really, really good books about how Ultra is used in the field and the impact it has on the operations. But then in the 90s, he writes another book called Behind the Battle, which has a chapter on Bomber Command. And Bennett's conclusions are a bit more nuanced. He doesn't deny that Ultra made its way to Harris, but he is broadly critical of him. He's broadly critical of his approach to intelligence and thinks more might be made of it. But the problem with Rafe Bennett is he worked in Hut 3. He has that first-hand experience of the production of Ultra and tends to have a blind spot for every other part of the organisation at Bletchley Park. So every part of his analysis is focused on Ultra signals and dissemination via the SLUs.
From his knowledge at the time?
It's both because of his personal knowledge and because that's the material he had access to in the archives in the late 70s.
What's the true story then? What's the real picture?
Bomber Command does get Ultra intelligence. And the key thing to understand here is there's more than one channel of dissemination. Bomber Command doesn't get a special liaison unit until 1944. But a lot of Ultra doesn't go for a special liaison unit. We think about commanders in the field receiving intelligence. That's how they get it. But most intelligence coming from Bletchley Park is not that sort of Ultra. It's the Ultra that goes into the ministries, you know, obviously in this case, the Air Ministry, and it's integrated into that big intelligence picture, which they build up. And there's all sorts of criticisms you can make about the intelligence service to Bomber Command via the Air Ministry and those BMP reports that we talked about in the other episodes again. But there's no reason to think that Bomber Command isn't getting background information from Ultra. It's not benefiting from that picture being built up at Bletchley Park. Air Ministry is doing its general intelligence reporting. It's either basing its conclusions on the big picture that they have down in Monk Street in London, based on Ultra, along with all the other sources they have, or they're sending it on in a camouflaged way. But Bomber Command is benefiting from that intelligence picture.
They're just not receiving it directly from Bletchley.
They're not receiving actual translated decrypts. Yeah. And then in 1944, Bomber Command does get a special liaison unit. And we know this because we can look at the Ultra, and I've found the first signal that goes out to Bomber Command. It's on the 9th of August, 1944. I mean, this is categorical evidence that it did go to Bomber Command. This is somewhat later than the 8th Air Force, so the American Strategic Bomber Forces get their Ultra service a bit earlier. Theirs starts up in May 1944. It's hard to know exactly what the reason for this is, but basically what you have to understand about special liaison units is they're intended to support commands out in the field. They're never for commands in the UK. No command in the UK has an SLU before early 1944, and they set them up before D-Day to basically make the system more consistent so that your overseas and your UK-based commands, because they will be working together during the invasion period, they have the same service via the SLUs, or they are fed intelligence by similar arrangements. And what it just seems to be the case is that before August 1944, there wasn't a belief that Bomber Command needed to be reading actual verbatim German decrypts.
Yeah.
And at that point, since you already have an SLU at 8th Air Force, which is based in High Wycombe, not far from Bomber Command, you can start sending signals to that SLU via their secure teleprinter link and take them up the road to Bomber Command, and that's a useful thing to feed into their picture. But it seems like it's left a bit later to set that up because it's not actually considered that essential.
And is this also down to not necessarily who's got an SLU, but who's actually cleared to read Ultra? Because that's a biggest issue, really.
Yeah, it's a question of who's on the Ultra list, right?
Yeah. And Harris must be.
He must be, right?
He's head of Bomber Command.
He's head of Bomber Command. This is the point. So we don't have the lists, and we can't point to a list with Bomber Harris's name on it. But he's the commander of a command. If we look at the Ultra regulations, which we have reproduced in the history of Hut 3, which you can find in the National Archives, they state that officers commanding SOUs are responsible for the secure distribution of special intelligence to the commanders to whom they are attached. Not to the command, to the commander. And authorised recipients automatically include Air Force Commanders-in-Chief, their senior Air Staff Officers and senior Air Intelligence Officers. So at Bomber Command, Bomber Harris, Bob Thornby, who's his Chief of Staff, and Noel Painter, who's his Chief of Intelligence, must have all been in the picture, according to these regulations. Now, John Stubbington contends that Painter was in the picture because he was the Chief Intelligence Officer, and he kind of fed the information to Harris, but Harris didn't know what it was.
That's ridiculous, because there would be a point where Harris would go, well, where have you got this from? Why do you know that? And also, they're having joint morning conferences with the 8th Air Force. I mean, he's going to turn around to the head of the 8th Air Force and say, well, how come you know this? I mean, it just seems ridiculous.
It causes all these problems, right? Yeah. And the thing you have to understand here is it's quite normal nowadays when military officers are very intelligence savvy and they have proper training to be given information and it's such and such security classification and you don't get told the source. And you know from the classification how kosher it is. During World War II, intelligence is in its infancy, and this is not the way things are done. The way things are done is the commander is in charge, and he has to know what his intelligence officers know. He has to at least be able to see it, even if he doesn't personally involve himself, because some, you know, as we've talked about in the past, some recipients of Ultra are really on it and have a lot of personal touch with the source, and some of them are more hands-off and leave it to their intelligence bods to feed them. But it doesn't mean they don't have a right to see it. That's something very, very different. So yeah, it might be fair to say Noel Painter's managing the intelligence side on behalf of Harris because Harris is incredibly busy just making those day-to-day command decisions. It doesn't mean Harris wasn't entitled to access Ultra. Now, we can't say Harris was on the list. Neither can we say Montgomery, Spots, Eisenhower, Alexander. And we know they got Ultra because of all the circumstantial evidence.
Yeah,
if they don't tell us themselves.
It just seems ridiculous that Harris is not on the list if his intelligence officer is, because he's in charge of the intelligence officer, so why wouldn't he be on the list? It doesn't add up.
So what's great is we don't need Harris's word that he got Ultra to assume that he probably did, almost certainly. But actually, we do have Harris's word for it.
We do, don't we? Because you've discovered this, haven't you?
Harris is the only officer that I can actually find who spoke on tape, on video, about receiving Ultra, which nobody else did that I can find. And so, yeah, you can go on YouTube, you can find an interview from 1977. He's interviewed by a group captain, Tony Mason. And this is an official interview from the Centre for Air and Space Power Studies, which is owned by the RAF.
I noticed on one occasion that the Enigma system, which was producing the information by tapping into the German intelligence network, produced a lot of information for our commanders. Was this information fed back to you as Commander-in-Chief?
I was never told of the source. But of course, any information that was relevant to my job was sent on to me.
Yes, yes.
But my view at the time, of course, was a view I've always held, that everybody always thinks their own code is unbreakable, and everybody always knows that you always break the other fellow's code. Yes.
What Harris says is exactly what you'd expect most Ultra recipients to know. Because most of these recipients don't have a good understanding of cryptography. They don't understand really what Enigma is. They do know, though, in broad terms, that the information is derived from Axis high-grade ciphers and that they can trust it. What's really interesting is to see how Harris's statement that, of course, any information which was relevant to my job was sent on to me. And by the way, it's worth pointing out, he shows no surprise at Enigma at this point. He doesn't make a point of contradicting the question he's being asked. He doesn't say, no, Enigma, I've never heard of it. He just simply says everything relevant to my job is being sent on to me. It's very interesting to see how this has been interpreted in light of the interpretations of people like Rafe Bennett as a denial of knowledge of Ultra.
But it's not.
Yeah, so if you look at Harris's biographer, Henry Probert, he actually interprets this statement as a denial and he actually misquotes it in order to strengthen that interpretation.
What, this one we've just played?
Absolutely.
Really?
And he talked about how he was amazed to hear that interview and hear Harris deny receiving intelligence. And Harris says, as far as I can work out, the exact opposite. And the problem is now these statements are out there from Rafe Bennett, from Henry Probert. They're repeated in many of the books without any further interrogation. When Harris says, I was never told of the source, you can read that as a denial of knowledge of Ultra. I was never told of the Ultra source. But I think a more plausible reading is to say he was referring to the technicalities of the cryptanalysis and he was saying, I never knew of the source of Ultra, but I did know of Ultra.
I didn't know this was coming from such and such a German ministry or from a police
or such and
unit.
Such a cipher key.
Yeah.
Why would he?
No.
Because it's not his job to know. He doesn't need to know that, but he does know of the source. But that sort of former, that negative interpretation is the one that's been chosen by Henry Probert, you know, consistent with the interpretation of Rafe Bennett. And then these claims that Harris didn't get Ultra are repeated in further books without any interrogation.
Well, they're false positives, aren't they?
And now the fact is out there that Harris didn't get Ultra, when, as far as I can tell, all the evidence is that he almost certainly did. And if we need any more evidence in favour, actually Henry Probert himself gives us two instances where Harris received intelligence which was referred to as Ultra in his correspondence.
Right.
One of those letters from Charles Portal makes a direct reference to Ultra, and Harris also receives a letter from Winston Churchill. referring to a particular Japanese diplomatic decrypt, which would have been classed as ultra.
Yeah.
And what's more likely, you have the Prime Minister and the Chief of the Air Staff fragrantly flouting the ultra regulations, or Bomber Harris was read on?
Yeah, I think I know which one's obvious.
Yeah.
I mean, also, we know that, as you've just said, in August 1944, he gets his own SLU anyway. So, as you've said, the SLU is to the commander, whether it's in the field or it's Bomber Command. So it doesn't make any sense that he didn't have access to Ultra.
Yeah, the evidence is pretty overwhelming.
I mean, do we know what was being sent to him when the SLU was in place?
Yeah, so I had a look. I looked at a week's worth of Enigma traffic.
All right.
I picked out all the messages that went to Bomber Command, because each Ultra signal has a number of what are called delivery groups attached to it, which tell you where it went. The code for Bomber Command is ML, and picked out all the ML messages, and I actually compared them to the ones going to 8th Air Force and US Strategic Air Forces as well.
Okay.
To assess the difference. And what you notice, that Ultra is almost all operational. It's information about German night fighter units. They're reporting their fuel stocks or the number of aircraft they've got or relocating from base to base. It's filling in that order of battle intelligence that I talked about earlier, the fact that Bomber Command knew what opposition it would be facing night by night. And you have odds and sods about all sorts of things that might impinge on operations. So you have reports of the movements of ships in case a crew comes down in the sea and then it has to be passed on to the SEA Rescue Service. You have information about air-launched V1 operations in case they're going to run into them on the way back from their bombing. You get some decrypts about day fighters, because presumably those are the day fighter units that also operate at night, and the assumption is that if they're operating the previous day and they take casualties, they'd be less of a threat the same night. You have all these operational tidbits, which are clearly feeding into that process of planning at Bomber Command. It's all very useful stuff. What you don't have is anything about targeting. You don't have anything about the oil campaign, because that's not the sort of red-hot tactical intelligence which the SLUs are designed to disseminate. So the point here is that if you contend that Bomber Harris might have been persuaded to hit oil targets more heavily if he had got better intelligence, it would have made the slightest bit of difference if he'd got an SLU earlier in 1944, because that wasn't what they were disseminating anyway.
No. I think you've proved your point there, Tom.
What you have to conclude is that if Harris was being obstinate and refusing to hit oil targets, and that's debatable, because I say those targets were hit by the end of 1944, and actually in 1945, something like 25% of Bomber Command's tonnage falls on oil targets. So he's on board by that stage.
Yeah.
But if you accept he could have taken a different approach and that would have led to a different outcome, you have to conclude that the problem here wasn't the intelligence. He was getting the intelligence he needed. Porter was able to refer in his correspondence to, I think, what he calls the irrefutable evidence of SIGINT in favour of bombing oil targets. And the reason that Harris doesn't play along is because simply he doesn't want to do that. He doesn't think it's the right approach. That would have been his opinion, no matter how much intelligence he would have got. So this counterfactual that maybe Bomber Harris could have been won around and the war would have been shortened if Air Ministry had done a better job of feeding intelligence to Bomber Command doesn't seem to hold any water at all. It's just wishful thinking. It's people who are morally opposed or morally uncertain about the rationale behind strategic bombing, begging the premise to try and imagine up a counterfactual where Harris might have been brought round to taking a different approach, which might have saved German lives, and it might have shortened the war and saved British and American lives as well.
In the greatest blitz on Germany, Allied airmen link up their attacks with Marshal Stalin's armies. British bombers head for Dresden, the Saxony bastion of the Nazis along the Eastern Front. And up comes Goebbels' newest secret weapon, a scarecrow, exploding like a plane hit by AK-AK. RAF Lancasters splashed 650,000 incendiary bombs on transportation lines in Germany's seventh largest city. They smash a big Reich roadblock across the Russian advance. Damage to Dresden, hampering the Wehrmacht, helps Konev's forces 70 miles away.
From the 60s onwards, really, well, in fact, probably earlier, he's painted as this ogre, isn't he, that all he wants to do is wipe out Germans. And the prime example of this is always given as the bombing of Dresden. And that proves, you know, there was no need to bomb Dresden. It was just as a whim by Harris that he wanted to wipe out another German city.
It's hard to find a specific intelligence rationale for the raid.
Okay.
I think the debate about whether it was a legitimate target is one that's still open. Dresden was a transport hub. It did have war industries. It wasn't bombed just because it was there. There was an Allied plan to bomb cities which were not too far from the front line in eastern Germany, which had not been previously bombed. That comes about in the middle of 1944 in the first instance, but then they decided to go ahead with it in January 1945. Dresden was in those discussions.
Did the Russians ask them to bomb
it? Russians, I don't think the Russians specifically are involved in those discussions, no. It's basically the Allied air forces, with the support of Winston Churchill, it must be said, decide to go ahead with raids on cities in eastern Germany and on Berlin as well. There's a whole series of raids. Places like Leipzig and Chemnitz as well are also bombed. The reason Dresden stands out is because everything went perfectly for the Dresden raid. The target marking is accurate. It's clear weather. The bombing is very, very concentrated. You get that firestorm effect and the casualties are enormous. The other reasons the raid is so notorious is because the city was seen as having particular cultural value and because the Nazis make such use of that in their propaganda immediately afterwards. And this is where we still hear these ridiculously inflated casualty claims that are straight from Goebbels' propaganda ministry in the days after the raid. You compare this to some of the other raids going on at the same time. There are raids which are nearly as heavy and as damaging on different cities, which nobody's ever heard of. There is a raid on Chemnitz the following night, which is a repeat of the Dresden raid, operationally speaking. But the difference is, in that case, the weather is bad, the target marking fails, most bombs fall outside the city, so Chemnitz doesn't get the same treatment as Dresden. But that's just a matter of luck. It's not because Dresden was singled out. And it's another interesting fact that the US Air Force, in the initial plan, was due to bomb the city the day before the RAF did. But the American raid was cancelled, and the RAF raid went ahead that night when the weather cleared up. And it's interesting to speculate whether, you know, the reputation of Harrison Bomber Command would be so bad now if the Americans had been the first to bomb Dresden and if Bomber Command had just turned up later that same night to bomb the rubble.
Well, the Americans do the opposite, don't they? They turn up the next day.
They turn up the next day, yeah. And they tend to get very little stick for it.
Does Dresden show up in any of the Ultra material at the time?
Not in a big way that I've been able to find out. It does seem that there is a bit of a flap in the Air Ministry just before the raid, looking for a pretext.
Before the raid?
Yeah, indeed. So what seems to happen on the day before the raid is that the US 8th Air Force, which is due to go first, puts about a story that there are German troop concentrations in Dresden. This is referred to in the official history, but it's discovered that there is kind of nothing in this story when the people involved try to get to the bottom of it. Now, Peter Calvacoresi, who's in Hut 3 at this point, he's head of the Hut 3 Air Section, he writes about how he was contacted by his predecessor in Hut 3A, a guy called Jim Rose, who's now at the Air Ministry, asking him if he has any information on 6th SS Panzer Army. This is one of the formations that had been involved in the Battle of the Bulge. It was now known to be heading back to the Eastern Front. And this is one of the problems Hut 3 was grappling with, is trying to work out which way they were going, because they don't know what route that formation is taking, possibly through Dresden, possibly by some other route. So Jim Rose says, do we have any evidence that 6th SS Panzer Army are passing through Dresden? And Calvacoresi replies, no, we don't have any specific evidence. That doesn't mean they aren't, because Ultra is never a negative source, necessarily, but we don't know. And if I quote from Calvacoresi, he says, Jim Rose replied that Dresden was to be heavily attacked and the movements of 6th SS Panzer were the pretext. He said that if I were entirely certain of what I told him, he would get onto the Allied air commanders and tell them that these grounds for bombing Dresden were not valid. I reiterated that we now knew what the orders to the army were, but as usual, could not rule out the possibility, however unlikely, that these orders could be changed or cancelled by telephone or by some other means not open to Ultra intelligence. So it seems that maybe had Ultra been available that was more specific, it could have been used to halt the raid. But as it was, the raid went ahead. And actually, Calvacoresi, he's writing a long time after the event anyway, so how much credence you can give to the story is kind of unclear. But he, you know, expresses doubt that the intelligence was really going to be decisive in the decision at any point. But what this whole story about Dresden, whatever the truth of it, kind of shows is that it is sometimes navel-gazing, really, to be talking about intelligence in the context of some decisions, because maybe intelligence just wasn't the important factor. These debates over intelligence and strategic bombing, they do rest on the assumption that there was good intelligence or there was a possibility of having good intelligence, and that it would have been listened to and it would have made a difference to the conduct of the campaign. And I don't think either assumption is really valid, because the intelligence problems are enormous, probably not completely solvable, and the Allied air commanders are going to do what they're going to do, in some cases, whatever the intelligence tells them. That assumption that Ultra knew everything, that if you had an SLU, you had the full picture. If you didn't have an SLU, you knew nothing, lead to all these misconceptions and lead to really skewed picture of how the decision making was happening. The reality is, you know, if you look back to Harris again, he had ample evidence had he wanted to find it or believe it. And his superiors had ample evidence to order him, by the way, to attack all the targets. And if he chose not to, that was for his own reason. It's a point that's been made by others. If Harris refused to do what his superiors were telling him to do, they were well within their rights to fire him, and they didn't. But whatever was going on here in these debates, intelligence is not the decisive factor. And it's kind of, as experts in the field, are flattering ourselves if we think that it always is the decisive factor, because sometimes there's just other things going on.
Out of the west, 1,350 American bombers of the 8th Air Force streak their vapor trails into the dawn. For two full days, miles of these bombers hammered Reich factory and railroad centers in the east. Chemnitz, Magdeburg, Cottbus. The veteran 1st Division of the 8th Air Force today carried its 200,000 ton of bombs to help an ally. Now they hit Dresden, hardest of all. The Blitz here, blasting away for the Russians now 45 miles away, links the two-front Allied drive from east and west on Berlin.
In conclusion, it's become very fashionable, especially, I would say, from the late 60s, early 70s onwards, to paint the strategic bombing campaign in a very dark light. It's very controversial. But what can we say about it from here, the intelligence picture? How does that play into that story?
It is a very important intelligence endeavour. You know, I might say that Ultra wasn't a decisive factor, but they did have a very large amount of good intelligence from Ultra and from other SIGINT sources about the effect the bombing was having on Germany. And from that point of view, it's one of the big impacts of what Bletchley Park was doing. There's a tendency to deny strategic bombing works. I don't think that's supportable. Just because Germany didn't collapse because of bombing, it's ludicrous to claim most of the German cities being near demolished had no effect on the German war effort. And it's worth noting the final campaign against oil and transport targets as well. They did work. By the end of the war, by the time the German army surrenders, they have no fuel. That's the reason they surrender. That's the reason they've lost. That's the reason they collapse. You don't see a moral collapse on the home front, no, but you see the strategic bombing having its effect on the ability of the German armed forces to continue fighting. And the reason they collapsed when they did was partly as the effect of that bombing. It's not an independent event. And from that point of view, intelligence was extremely important. It's just we have to add that usual caveat. The Ultra never tells you exactly what you should do. It just gives you options. It's always conditioned by whether the customer wants to use it and knows how to use it. And if they choose not to use it, there's not much the intelligence specialist can do about it. Their preconceptions, their plan of campaign that they've already decided on will take precedence.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.